Usually when you think about cannabis, the image that jumps to mind is, well, it's entirely cultural.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You picture the tie-dye shirts or, the 1970s counterculture movements, or maybe just like a hazy college dorm room from a movie.
Right. It's a very specific vibe.
Exactly. It is so wrapped up in this incredibly thick layer of like sociology and politics and pop culture that we tend to see it strictly as a lifestyle choice.
Yeah, we just see the bumper stickers, the endless debates.
Right. But if you strip all of that away, like if you take away the culture and the laws, what you are actually left with is fundamentally just a key.
A chemical key.
Yeah, a single silent molecule floating through your bloodstream, looking for a very specific microscopic lock that your brain built entirely for itself.
Which is, that really is a profound shift in perspective for anyone trying to understand this
It
topic.
really is.
Because you aren't introducing some completely alien invader into your system when you consume this plant, You are introducing a molecule that happens to perfectly fit a complex network that your neurons already use.
They use it every single day.
Exactly. The brain already has the infrastructure just waiting there.
And that is exactly what we are getting into today. So, welcome to the deep dive. For you listening right now, we are taking a completely different approach today.
Yeah, no politics today.
None at all. We are not talking about cannabis culture,
Yeah.
and we certainly aren't debating politics.
Yeah.
We are popping the hood and looking directly at the actual brain mechanics.
The real science.
Exactly. Our source material today is this fascinating neuroscience-first article from the OOTW Journal. It's titled The Neuroscience of THC: How Cannabis Works.
It's a great piece, very thorough.
It really is. So our mission for this deep dive is to, cut through all the noise you usually hear. We're going to explore exactly how this one plant molecule fits into our brain's existing hardware.
Right. And what the hard medical evidence actually proves versus, well, what is just dispensary marketing?
Yes, exactly. And we'll get into how skyrocketing potency combined with the major 2026 legal shifts are like completely changing the landscape.
Because the stakes are simply higher than they used to be. The substance itself has changed so dramatically over the last few decades that the old cultural narrative, they just don't apply anymore.
They really don't.
We have to look closely at what the neurobiology actually shows us.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand THC, you actually have to understand that your body makes its own versions of it.
Which is wild.
That is the part that totally blew my mind. The human brain has its own internal network called the endocannabinoid system.
It is a remarkable system, and historically, the scientific community actually found the locks before they realized the brain was manufacturing its own keys.
Oh, really? That's kind of backwards.
Yeah, it's a funny quirk of the history. Researchers had isolated THC from the cannabis plant way back in 1964. That was Raphael Mechoulam's lab in Jerusalem, but they didn't know exactly how it worked in the body. It wasn't until the early 1990s that the very same lab discovered the brain's homegrown versions of these
Whoa,
molecules.
wow. So decades later.
Decades. They finally found these internal ligands and realized our bodies are producing similar compounds all the time.
Wait, just so we don't lose anyone in the terminology, what exactly is a ligand?
Oh, good question. A ligand is just a scientific term for any molecule that binds to a receiving receptor.
Okay, got it.
Think of it as that key we mentioned earlier, specifically shaped to fit a certain lock on the surface of a cell.
Right.
When Mechoulam's team found the body's natural keys, they named the first one anandamide. They actually took inspiration from the Sanskrit word for bliss, which is ananda.
The bliss molecule. I love that.
Yeah, it's very fitting. And shortly after, they found another one called 2-AG. So these are fatty acid messengers that your brain produces on its own to regulate various functions.
So normally, when I think about how brain cells talk to each other, I imagine them like passing notes in one
Like
direction.
a relay race.
Exactly. One cell fires off a chemical message, and the next cell receives it and passes it down the line. It's a forward-marching process. But this source text explains that these natural endocannabinoids, like anandamide, operate completely in reverse.
Yeah, that backward movement is called retrograde signaling. And it is, honestly, it's crucial to understanding how the whole system operates.
Okay, walk me through that.
Imagine a scenario where the receiving cell, so the postsynaptic neuron, is getting absolutely bombarded with excitatory signals.
It's basically getting yelled at by the other cells.
Exactly, it's becoming overwhelmed. In that exact moment, it synthesizes these endocannabinoids on demand. It literally makes them right then and there.
Wow.
And then it sends them backward across the synaptic gap to the sending cell, the presynaptic terminal.
Okay.
They bind to what is called the CB1 receptor on that sending cell. So the entire system acts as a precision dimmer switch.
A dimmer switch.
Right. Its job is to suppress excess neurotransmitter release and keep your neural circuits in perfect balance.
Okay, so I was thinking about this, and tell me if this analogy works. Think of your natural endocannabinoids like a bouncer at a very specific, exclusive club door.
Okay, I like where this is going.
The bouncer occasionally spots a rowdy patron, which is our sending neuron, and just taps them on the shoulder saying, hey, lower your voice a bit, you're getting too loud.
Yes.
It's a highly targeted, brief interaction. But when you introduce THC into this equation, it's like a massive flash mob of bouncers suddenly showing up at every single club in the entire city at the exact same time, and they stay there for hours.
What's fascinating here is that your bouncer analogy is mechanistically perfect.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, because THC hijacks that precise feedback loop. Instead of the brief, local, on-demand puff of natural anandamide designed to calm down one specific connection.
Single tap on the shoulder.
Right. THC floods the CB1 receptors indiscriminately across the entire brain. And because it stays in your system for hours rather than just seconds, that delicate precision dimmer switch becomes a blunt brain-wide dampening effect.
Which, I mean, that makes total sense of why being high feels so all-encompassing. It isn't just targeting one feeling or one thought.
Exactly.
It sprawls across your memory, your coordination, your appetite, and your mood all at once.
There is a vital pharmacological nuance to add, though. THC is what we call a partial agonist at that CB1 receptor.
It's our partial agonist, meaning it doesn't do the full job.
Sort of. It binds to the lock, but it doesn't turn it all the way. It nudges the receptor rather than slamming it to its absolute maximum capacity.
Oh, I see.
The partial activation is essentially the personality of the drug. Because it has a built-in ceiling effect, it offers a relatively forgiving safety profile when you compare it to other, you know, recreational or prescription drugs.
Which begs the question, if THC is acting like this massive flash mob of bouncers indiscriminately flooding the brain, why doesn't it shut down the vital functions that keep you alive?
Right. The answer to that comes down to the brain's real estate. Where these CB1 receptors are physically located dictates exactly what THC can and cannot do to you.
Location, location, location.
Exactly. The receptors are incredibly dense in specific areas. For example, the hippocampus, which governs memory formation.
Which perfectly explains why someone under the influence might, like, walk into a kitchen and completely forget why they went in there.
Classic symptom, yeah.
The hippocampus is getting suppressed by that slash mob, so short-term memories just fail to form.
They are also highly concentrated in the basal ganglia and the cerebellum. Those are the regions responsible for your movement, balance, and coordination.
Okay, so that's the motor impairment side of things.
Right. When THC dampens those areas, your reaction time slows down, your balance shifts, and complex motor tasks become really difficult. And they're also dense in the cortex, which alters your sensory perception and thought patterns.
But, and this is a huge but, the source text points out a massive geographical blank spot.
It does.
These CB1 receptors are conspicuously sparse in the brainstem. And the brainstem is the body's literal control center for autonomic functions, like keeping your heart beating and maintaining your breathing rhythm while you sleep.
That single neuroscientific fact explains why a cannabis overdose doesn't cause lethal respiratory depression.
Which is totally different from opioids.
Completely different. If you look at opioids, the receptors for drugs like heroin or fentanyl are densely packed right into the brainstem.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so if someone takes too much, the drug directly shuts down the respiratory centers and the person simply stops breathing. THC physically cannot do that. The biological locks required to turn off your lungs simply do not exist in high enough numbers in that part of the brain.
I do want to make sure we highlight something the article is super careful about, though. Low lethality does not mean harmless.
Absolutely not, no.
People are still ending up in the emergency room for severe panic attacks, psychotic episodes, and cardiovascular events. And a lot of those ER visits seem to trace back to edibles.
Very true.
Which leads right into this fascinating biological variable. How the drug enters your body fundamentally changes what the drug actually is.
It really does. The route of administration changes the chemistry. When someone inhales THC, the molecule travels through the lungs directly into the bloodstream and hits the brain in, you know, minutes.
Fast in, fast out.
Right. The onset is rapid, the peak is fast, and it fades out relatively quickly. But swallowing it in the form of a brownie or a gummy forces the molecule to take a massive biological detour.
It goes straight to the stomach.
It travels through the digestive system and is routed directly to the liver.
And the liver's entire job is to process chemicals.
Right.
It doesn't just let the THC pass through into the bloodstream untouched. It metabolizes it.
Right.
The liver converts a huge fraction of that delta-9 PHC into a completely different molecule called 11-hydroxy-THC.
That process is known as first-pass metabolism. And 11-hydroxy-THC is significantly more potent, highly psychoactive, and much longer-lasting than the original molecule.
So you're basically manufacturing a new drug inside yourself.
Essentially, yes. You take one drug and your body manufactures a stronger variant of it internally.
And because of that liver processing, there is a massive metabolic delay. It can take anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 full hours to feel the effects of an edible.
Right, which leads to trouble.
For you listening, if you have ever wondered why eating cannabis feels like a totally different experience than smoking it, this is the biological cheat code. That 2-hour delay is the exact cause of what the article perfectly labels the edible catastrophe.
Ah, yes. I don't feel anything yet, so I should probably take another one.
We have all heard that exact story from someone or been that person. By the time the liver finally finishes processing that first dose and releases the 11-hydroxy-THC into the brain, the person has already eaten a second or third dose.
Yep, and then it all hits.
The body is suddenly hit with a massive compounding wave of this highly potent metabolite, leading to profound anxiety, paranoia, and a high that can last for the better part of a day.
It perfectly illustrates how altering the delivery method completely alters the medical and psychological outcome.
It really does.
And that metabolic reality forces us to ask a very serious question about the broader medical claims surrounding cannabis. We have to separate what the hard, rigorous clinical evidence actually supports from what is driven by, well, dispensary marketing.
Oh, man, yeah. If you walk into a modern dispensary, the marketing suggests this plant cures literally everything from insomnia to chronic illness.
A very long list of claims.
But the article points us to the absolute benchmark for truth on this. The 2017 National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine Review. The NASEM Review.
Right, a huge study.
They didn't just run a small trial. They screened over 10,000 scientific abstracts.
10,000?
Yeah. They filtered through decades of noise, weak studies, and purely anecdotal claims to find the actual rigorous clinical data.
And out of those 10,000 abstracts, the committee found only 3 specific areas with conclusive or substantial evidence for therapeutic use.
Just 3.
Just 3. The first is the treatment of adult chronic pain, though the data notes the effect sizes are generally modest.
Okay, so it helps, but it's not a miracle cure for pain.
Right. The second is chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. And the third is multiple sclerosis spasticity symptoms. It's also worth noting that the relief for MS spasticity is predominantly documented using oral cannabinoid preparations, not smoked flower.
Which is a huge distinction. This feels like the perfect time to address the other massive compound of the plant, CBD, cannabidiol.
Oh, yeah, the famous cousin.
Exactly, the non-intoxicating cousin of THC. From what I understand, CBD has a very low affinity for that CB1 receptor in the brain, so it doesn't trigger the flash mob effect.
Right, it doesn't produce a high.
But the highest regulatory bar cleared by any cannabis-derived medicine is an FDA-approved drug called Epidiolex.
Yeah, Epidiolex is a fascinating milestone in all this. It is used to treat extremely rare, severe forms of childhood epilepsy, specifically Dravet syndrome and Lennox-Gastaut syndrome.
And it works well.
It does. It reduces seizure frequency in ways other medications fail to do.
But here is where I have to push back on a massive industry talking point. Epidiolex is a highly purified, THC-free CBD isolate.
Just the one molecule.
Yes, just the one molecule. If you spend any time looking into cannabis marketing, you constantly hear about the entourage effect. This theory that whole plant cannabis, with all its mixed cannabinoids and natural terpenes, is biologically superior to isolated compounds.
Right.
Wait, it's the most scientifically validated, FDA-approved medicine we have is a highly purified isolate like Epidiolex. Isn't the entourage effect mostly just a marketing buzzword running way ahead of the actual clinical data?
Your skepticism is entirely validated by the research. Yeah, the source text explicitly addresses this, calling the entourage effect contested and under-evidenced.
Oh.
The theory sounds incredibly plausible on a biological level, you know, that these compounds work synergistically, but the controlled human data supporting it are thin, inconsistent, and difficult to reproduce.
So it's mostly a sales pitch.
Much of the hike driving the entourage effect is commercial rather than clinical.
Hmm.
People want a holistic, natural remedy, so the marketing just leans into that desire.
We really do need to be careful about the claims we accept as fact, primarily because the plant being sold today is not the plant from the medical studies of the 1990s.
Oh, not even close.
The source text outlines a pharmacological trend that is honestly staggering. In the mid-1990s, the average THC content in seized cannabis was hovering around, what, 4%?
Yeah, about 4%. But fast forward to the 2025 legal market, and the baseline has shifted completely. Typical legal flower now averages between 22 and 28% THC.
That's a massive jump.
And when you look at concentrates, the waxes, the vape oils, the shatter that have become wildly popular, they are routinely hitting 80 to 95% THC.
95%?
Yes. The 4% plant from the 1990s effectively no longer exists in the commercial market.
That skyrocketing potency directly collides with a really tricky biological mechanism regarding anxiety.
Oh, the biphasic effect.
Right. The article explains that THC has a biphasic effect on human anxiety, meaning it behaves in completely opposite ways depending on the dosage you receive.
Exactly. At very low doses, THC can act as an anxiolytic. It can physically calm the nervous system down.
Which is why people say it helps them relax.
Right. But at high doses, it flips. It reliably provokes anxiety, paranoia, and in some cases, severe panic.
So if the plant is now pushing 25% potency and the vapes are at 90%, it becomes virtually impossible for a casual user to get that low, calming dose.
You blow right past it.
Yeah, or instantly hitting the high dose threshold. How does that rewrite the risk profile, especially for vulnerable people whose brains are still developing?
Well, the risk math changes entirely, particularly for adolescents. Remember that the endocannabinoid system isn't just a volume knob for your daily mood.
Right.
It plays an active structural role in guiding neural wiring during brain development, both in utero and throughout adolescence.
That sounds critical.
It is. During your teenage years, your brain is undergoing a vital process called synaptic pruning, where it cuts away unused connections to refine the prefrontal cortex for adult decision making.
So what happens when you introduce massive amounts of 90% THC concentrate into a teenage brain that is trying to delicately prune its own synapses?
The consequences are measurable. The Imogen Consortium, which conducts massive prospective neuroimaging studies, has linked teenage cannabis use to accelerated cortical thinning.
Accelerated thinning?
Yes, the actual physical cortex of the developing brain thins out faster than it should. We also see longitudinal data associating heavy teenage use with lasting deficits in memory, sustained attention, and processing speed.
So what does this all mean for the average adult user?
I think we have to confront the reality of dependence. There is this incredibly stubborn cultural myth that it is biologically impossible to get addicted to weed.
It's a very pervasive myth.
But the medical literature clearly defines cannabis use disorder, or CUD.
It is a formalized diagnosis in the DSM-5. Current data suggests roughly 1 in 10 adult users will develop it.
1 in 10.
And that risk percentage jumps significantly if the person begins using during adolescence or if they use high-potency products on a daily basis.
And it comes with a physical withdrawal syndrome, right? People experience severe irritability, profound sleep disruption, and a total loss of appetite when they stop.
Yes, physical withdrawal is a documented reality.
Acknowledging that physical withdrawal completely shatters the outdated 1970s narrative that this is a 100% harmless botanical.
Exactly. And we are also witnessing a sharp rise in a condition called cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, or CHS.
Oh, this is the one that blew my mind. It's awful. This affects chronic, heavy users who suddenly develop severe cyclic episodes of vomiting and abdominal pain.
And the treatment for it is so bizarre.
The bizarre hallmark of this syndrome is that patients compulsively take scalding hot showers, as the intense heat on the skin seems to be the only thing that temporarily relieves the nausea.
That is just wild.
It was a medical anomaly before 2004, but with the rise of concentrates, it is now a frequent presentation in emergency rooms across the country.
Then there's the deeply debated risk regarding psychosis. The article handles this carefully, avoiding fear-mongering, but presenting the data. Heavy use of high-potency cannabis is repeatedly linked to an elevated risk of developing schizophrenia and experiencing an earlier onset of psychotic disorders.
The key phrase epidemiologists use here is component cause.
Component cause.
Right. Cannabis is not the singular, isolated cause of schizophrenia. If a completely healthy person with no genetic risk smokes cannabis, it does not spontaneously create schizophrenia out of nowhere.
Okay, that's an important distinction.
However, for individuals who carry a genetic vulnerability to psychotic disorders, flooding the brain with high-potency THC can precipitate or severely accelerate the onset of psychosis. It acts as a powerful catalyst in a complex web of existing risks.
All of this rapidly shifting science, you know, the potency, the brain development risks, the medical realities, is exactly why the legal system is scrambling to rewrite the rules.
They're trying to keep up.
As of 2026, the regulatory framework has shifted dramatically. Let's look objectively at where the federal law actually stands right now, purely focusing on the facts of the legislation.
Sure. Following an executive order issued in December 2025, the DEA made a historic administrative move in April 2026.
Right.
They officially moved FDA-approved cannabis products and state-licensed medical cannabis down to Schedule 3 of the Controlled Substances Act.
Which is a massive shift.
Yeah.
Moving to Schedule 3 essentially acknowledges that these specific regulated products have accepted medical use.
Exactly.
It completely opens the door for rigorous clinical research that was previously blocked. And it removes punishing tax burdens for state-licensed medical dispensaries.
Yes, but importantly, all other recreational marijuana remains locked in Schedule of S, which is the most restrictive category, alongside heroin.
Right, they split the difference. Simultaneously, Congress has been aggressively moving to close the notorious hemp loophole created by the 2018 Farm Bill.
Oh, the Delta 8 issue.
Yeah. That piece of agricultural legislation was originally intended to legalize industrial hemp for things like rope and textiles.
Innocent enough.
But because it defined hemp as any cannabis plant with less than 0.3% Delta-9 THC, chemists figured out how to extract legal CBD from hemp and synthetically convert it into intoxicating variants like Delta-8 THC.
A massive loophole.
It accidentally birthed a multi-billion dollar, completely unregulated market of psychoactive gummies sold at gas stations. Which lawmakers are now systematically phasing into restriction?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it becomes incredibly clear that the science is neither inherently pro-cannabis nor anti-cannabis.
Exactly.
The science just demands extreme specificity. Whether this plant acts as a modest medical relief or a severe psychological catalyst is entirely dictated by the dosage you take, your age when you start, how the drug enters your liver, and your own unique genetic vulnerabilities.
It is a wildly complex biological landscape that just refuses to fit neatly into a political slogan or a marketing campaign.
It really is.
Let's quickly recap the journey we just took. We learned that THC isn't just an outside invader. It is a partial agonist that happens to perfectly mimic our brain's natural bliss molecule.
Anandamide.
Right. It hijacks an internal endocannabinoid system that was designed to precisely regulate everything from memory formation in the hippocampus to motor control in the basal ganglia.
We saw how routing it through the liver transforms it into the much more potent 11-hydroxy-THC, causing those infamous edible delays.
The edible catastrophe. We also sifted through 10,000 abstracts to find the narrow, proven medical applications, and we confronted the reality that modern products pushing 90% potency are forcing both neurologists and lawmakers to rapidly rethink their approach to public safety.
Understanding the actual mechanics fundamentally changes how you view the substance.
Yeah.
You know, this raises an important question, and it is a concept I want to leave floating in the air for you to ponder.
Okay, I'm ready.
The source text notes that chronic heavy exposure to high-potency THC causes our brain's CB1 receptors to downregulate and desensitize.
Meaning they pull back?
Yes. The brain essentially retreats from the chemical flood, pulling its receptors back inside the cells to protect itself from overstimulation.
It is the brain's way of trying to find balance during an endless flash mob.
Exactly. So if our natural endocannabinoid system is our body's built-in evolutionary mechanism for regulating stress, maintaining balance, and experiencing ananda, our everyday natural bliss. What happens to our baseline capacity for natural joy and emotional resilience when we artificially exhaust and downregulate that very system?
Wow. That is a heavy, fascinating thought to sit with. If you chronically wear out the biological system meant to give you peace, finding peace naturally in your everyday life becomes that much harder.
It's real consequence.
Well, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the true neuroscience of THC. Keep learning, keep questioning the consensus, and always stay curious. See you next time.